I think I tell you it's an agency bill.
I would like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order for Monday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day, everyone. Also, let the record state there is a quorum present. We have a pretty long list of bills today, so we'd like to get started right away with Senator Tomasoni with Senate File 1879. Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and happy St. Patrick's Day to you also. Mr. Chairman, do you want to put the A1 amendment on the bill? Puts the bill in the form that we need to have it in, and it's my understanding that the A1 amendment defines the skills and experiences that are needed to qualify for the grants program, and it corrects an error from the start date of the grants program from July 1, 16 to July 1, 15.
Okay, members, that author's amendment should be coming around, so this would put the bill in the shape the author would prefer. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And Senate File 1879 amends Minnesota Statute 268A and adds deaf-blind and hard of hearing workers to the supported employment grant program as required to be offered by the state. 268A currently only covers workers with mental illness and people with severe disabilities. From 1993 to 2011, the state allocated funds for employment supports for people who are deaf, deaf-blind, and hard of hearing, youth, and adults without a policy in place. In 2011, that changed. Legislature put workforce development training dollars into a competitive grant pool, and deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind became the only disability group that had to compete for funds. This put workers who are deaf, deaf-blind, and hard of hearing at risk of losing their jobs. The services were primarily offered in the metro area. The workers from Greater Minnesota moved to the Twin Cities to receive the service. The bill requires that the grant program be offered statewide. Passing this bill will also help the state comply with the federal court order. The state Olmstead plan was submitted in November 1 of 2013 in response to a federal court order that requires the state to ensure that people with disabilities live and are employed and supported in the most integrated settings. Passing this bill will help to demonstrate the state's commitment to employing people with disabilities, in this case adults and transitioned age youth 18 to 21 who are deaf and hard of hearing. With me today is Blaine Newberg from the Minnesota Employment Center for the Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and I'll turn this over to him.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, and thank you. Appreciate your hearing our testimony today on this. My name is Blaine Newberg. I'm Program Director with the Minnesota Employment Center. Over the last 20 years, MEC has supported over 1,200 deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind individuals at work. We've also worked with around 400 different employers in the state, from small mom-and-pop businesses to some Fortune 500 companies. These ongoing supports that we provide, they ensure that the employees keep their jobs and move away from public assistance, while at the same time we're helping businesses with their bottom line. We're helping them recruit good workers, and we're saving them some money on their training and replacing staff when they turn over. We had, as Senator Tomasoni said, line item funding until the change to the competitive process in 2011. The thing that didn't change, though, is the need for these supports that we're providing. So we are asking that deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind individuals be added under EE. This will preserve the efficiency and productivity gains of the competitive process while also moving forward the state Olmstead plan. This will also require that the services be extended statewide, not just to the metro area, and that's something that we are really excited to do, and we're hoping that this will allow us to expand into Virginia, Duluth, Rochester, St. Cloud, and Mankato. So thank you for supporting our bill and ensuring that deaf, hard of hearing Minnesotans will keep working and contributing to society. I'd like to introduce now Greta Palmberg with the Vector Program.
Thank you very much, Mr. Newberg. Ms. Palmberg, welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Greta Palmberg. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I want to thank Senator Tomasoni for his unrelenting support of this important issue. I'm an educator with Vector Transition Services, and since 1987, we've been specializing in deaf and hard of hearing employment and post-secondary support services for students ages 18 to 21. Nationally, 53% of deaf and hard of hearing young adults have completed any type of post-secondary education. Employment statistics are also dismal. In 2011, only 48% of deaf adults were employed, and with many of these being underpaid, underemployed, and unable to make career advancements. But over the last 5 years, 90% of our Vector students have gotten jobs or were enrolled in post-secondary education at the time of graduation. I'd like for you to remember your first job. Mine was a sophomore in high school at a hot dog stand in a suburban Chicago neighborhood. And although it wasn't my match for my desired career, it served as the critical introduction to the world of work for me, where the job skills I developed and the lessons that I learned as an employee paved the way for future employment. Now I want you to imagine that you are a young adult who is deaf or hard of hearing, facing companies and hiring managers who are unable to overcome a perceived barrier in communication. And you will begin to see why more than 85% of our students who start our program have never had this first competitive job experience, even at the age of 18 to 21. It takes specialized skills and training to equip these students with the self-advocacy and communication strategies they need, not to mention those basic job skills. But equally as important, it takes transition staff who can break down these barriers with companies, who are often reluctant to hire these students into minimum wage jobs due to perceived difficulty and expense. Providing these specialized services is labor intensive. From 2007 to 2011, the state allocated workforce development funds that helped our regional program maintain our critical mass of deaf and hard of hearing students while also retaining services of specialized staff. But in 2011, the state put all the funds for youth into a competitive grant program. Competing with these large youth programs has resulted in significant decrease in funding and a reduction in services. The state has determined that workers with mental illness need employment supports as well as those with severe disabilities. We believe that students who are deaf and hard of hearing need those employment supports as well. To help illustrate my point, I have brought a current student from Vector, Moises Prince, and his father, George Prince.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Moises Prince. I'm originally from Mexico, and I moved to the U.S. when I was 11 years old. In Mexico, my education was poor. I didn't learn anything because I was the only deaf student and the teacher didn't know how to communicate with me. When I came here in 2006 in fifth grade, I continued to live in Bemidji until I graduated high school. At the age of 19, I went to the Vector, where I started learning independent living skills. My first year at Vector, I learned about money management, getting a driver's license, and improving my reading and math skills. I have an interest in becoming a career chef. I've taken some independent living cooking courses. And I've had jobs. I worked at the Minnesota Conservation Corps, and I've worked for my father's company. However, I've never had any competitive employment, and I would like to work independently. Myself, along with other deaf and hard of hearing students, need help finding jobs. Finding jobs close to where we live. We need assistance in learning communication and interviewing skills. And what's really important for us is having somebody who understands deaf people to communicate with the companies on our behalf. This job support is critical. I want to have real job experience. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time today, and I hope that you'll support this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prince.
Good job.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is George Prince. I am Moises' adopted father. You can see I don't have any notes, any talking points in front of me. I'm just here as a concerned parent and as an advocate for this bill, for Moises and for Minnesotans like him. If I could, I'd like to share just a little bit about our family history. You know, as Moises mentioned, we're from Bemidji, Minnesota, and you can see that Moises is growing up to be a fine young man. And as he did, as most of your sons and daughters would say to you, how about a part-time job, Dad? I'd like to have a job. And so as we made the rounds in Bemidji to see if there were employment opportunities for Moises, time and time again, we ran into concerns about communication. Well, I've been blessed and fortunate enough to be a part owner in my own manufacturing company, so I was able to bring Moises in and to provide him some opportunities and experiences through employment with my firm. But as many of you know who may have worked with your parents or had your children work for you, is not exactly a true independent employment experience, and there's quite a bit that's missed. As time went by, Moises, of course, was looking for more opportunities, and again, I was blessed to serve as a member of the board of directors for a company called ODC in Bemidji, which specializes in finding employment and opportunities for people with disabilities. However, even in Bemidji, they had never had a person work in their facility who relied solely on ASL, and so there was some hesitation there as well. However, they were willing to take a chance on Moises and gave him an opportunity, and he was able to work at least a summer program with them. But obviously, again, it took a great deal of work on my part to be able to facilitate that and also to do some preliminary translation work due to not having those resources available to us. When I look at Moises, I see a lot of potential, a lot of energy, a lot of desire to move forward. And I see these types of resources, these types of programs, and this type of bill as being necessary and very much needed to help him move forward and other Minnesotans like him. I'm just very blessed to have been able to be introduced to Vector here in the Metro to be able to access their services and to be able to put Moises in a place where he's going to be given the greatest opportunity to be successful. So I thank you for your time today. I ask you to support Moises and to support this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prince, for sharing your story. And obviously, this program has worked quite well, obviously, for you and your family. So we're grateful that you shared that with us. Members, do you have any questions for any of the witnesses? Senator Bonner?
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. I'm proud to be a co-author on this bill. And I loved hearing Moises tell his story. And so I urge that we do pass this bill.
Thank you.
Sure. Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Tomasoni, I see there's no dollars in the grant program. Where are you looking for those dollars to come from? I also see there's an appropriation for the administration. Is that appropriation 5%? Is that going to be of the amounts that the grants are for?
Senator Tomasoni, or maybe to...
I'll get someone to answer.
Okay.
Answer.
We've got someone coming up to the table, Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. In response to the question, we saw that 268A had in place policies that required grants to be provided without dollars attached to them. So because this is the policy committee, we were coming before you with that without a request for funding, and this wouldn't become effective until the next to the next biennium.
Senator Dames. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give some idea, ma'am, of what type of dollars you might be looking at or thinking about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in the past, the funding requests were about 360. The funding that the organizations received were about 360, and averaged for the youth program and averaged to be about 400,000. We asked different providers how much it would cost to expand statewide, and it would be an additional approximately $550,000, so about $1.2 million.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Hartnett. Senator Tomasoni, do you want this bill to go to finance or go to your committee, or would you want it to go to the floor?
I think it goes to the floor. Yeah, I don't think it has any funding in it.
Okay, so. Okay. Any further discussion? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1878? Senator Nelson.
I just have a question. Did I hear there's no funding?
Well, not within the bill itself. but within the 268A there is.
Maybe you want to try to help.
Okay.
Okay. Is that right?
Are we voting on the amendment or the?
We've already put the A1 amendment on.
Yep.
So we haven't, have a motion yet, but then the next motion would be to pass it out as amended and be recommended to go to the Senate floor.
Mr. Chair?
Effective until July 1,
15. Mr. Chair?
Senator Nelson.
Well, I support this bill. I think it's a wonderful idea. It kind of reminds me of something we did similar with highly functioning autism young adults, and it's been very successful in having those work supports. And but my question is the funding. It seems to me that there is funding, but I'm just wondering where it is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Nelson, this is speaks to a policy change to require that the state issue grants. Right now, the state requires that grants be issued or offered for employment supports to people with mental illness and to people with severe disabilities, but they do not require that they be offered to people who are deaf and hard of hearing. It was, in fact, a practice from the 1990s until 2011. There were line item funding. There was line item funding for this, but there was no policy when the policy that required that it be provided. And so the way that funds were distributed changed, and all funding for employment training went into a competitive grant program, and deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind became the only group that was with disabilities that was required to compete against people without disabilities. So this is a policy change, and then it would be something that would be required to be offered next year, and then we would need to look at the funding and how much the funding would be in the next fiscal, in the next biennium.
Thank you. Just to follow up, Mr.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you for that clarification. And then my last question, knowing that now, the administration cost of up to 5% of the biennial appropriation under this section is available for administration of the program. Is that consistent with the other eligible grant seekers?
Ms. Harnett.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, it is, I believe. But I believe the department is here if they'd like to speak to that. But I believe that that's, on average, what the cost is. If the department could speak to that if they,
okay.
they're here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You can just shake your head yes if you want.
Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Harnett, could you tell me, are you asking to have the class, you know, the deaf blind, and the hard of hearing, are you asking to have those folks included in the current grants, or are you asking for new grants?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we were asking that there be a new grant section. That there is currently a grant section for people with mental illness, and there is currently a grant section for people with severe disabilities. We are asking for a new grant section for deaf blind, and hard of hearing.
And Mr. Chairman, so
Senator Thomas
and Senator Deems, I think the intent here is that this would go into effect on July 1st of 2015, so it would be part of the new grant cycle when we do our budgeting the next time around. This is just getting the policy put in place so that they become part of the grant cycle the next time.
Okay. Thank you. Someone from the department want to comment?
Mr. Chair, Senators, may I have the question repeated again so I can be precise?
That was my question. Thank
you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was about line 1.35 and 1.36 on the A1 amendment, which just had to do with the administration costs. The language says that up to 5% of the biennial appropriation under this section is available for administration of the program. And my question is this amount consistent with other grant seekers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, first of all, for the record, my name is John Sherman. I'm the director of the Extended Employment Program at Vocational Rehabilitation Services in the department. It's consistent with the policies that have been adopted for the adult and youth workforce grants. It is not consistent with policy in extended employment in 268A or 15 or 268A.13.14.
Senator Nelson.
So, Mr. Chair, could you tell me what the difference is then?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, the difference is essentially that there is an overall policy within the department, within statutory language, that allows for up to 5% to be taken out of administrative, out of grant sections. There, both of the other programs have historically had an established staff and NPS figure that has been part of almost the history of the program, and in both cases that's 15 to 20 years. I'm not particularly certain why, when this language and the other bills were originally established, 5% or some equivalent was not provided. That's earlier in the history of the department, but I can tell you that based on the existing language, this would be new language for 15, and by the way, I believe appropriate language.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fuller, I think, might have something that would help clear this up a little bit further, too, members.
Mr. Chair, this is just technical. I think on line 35, it refers to under. Well, there is no appropriation under this section. So I would say delete under and insert for the purposes of. And then on line 36, this is a – why don't you move this?
Okay. Senator Tomasoni, do you understand that amendment?
I'll make that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Nelson moves that oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, on line 36, it says, is available for administration of the program. Is that intended to be the department's cost or the underlying grantee's cost? Or oftentimes we say is available to the department or the commissioner for administration. So is the, this is just a question. Is that what you intend, or do you intend a total of 5% off of everything for any particular grant, including the department and the grantee, is limited to 5%? Or just the, usually it's the department, I believe. But
Mr. Sherman, you want to try that one?
I think you are, Mr. Chair, I think it's treading into deep waters for myself, because the department is a little larger than the section of the unit that I know, that I go through. Mr. Fuller is correct. There is no direct appropriation for these dollars, so that for that section at this point, there would be no administrative expenses taken, 5% of zero being zero. But the assumption is if a direct appropriation is made to fund this section, then that language would then allow the department to undertake administrative costs, which are necessary given the requirements for monitoring, contract administration, budget development, and just general oversight. And, in fact, it has been an issue, at least in the prior program, where there was a direct appropriation to deaf and hard of hearing services. I was the contract administrator for a period of time under that direct appropriation, and there literally was no place to, bluntly put, charge my expenses or charge the contract expenses. And we were called on it by the Office of Legislative Auditor in one of their site reviews about 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sherman, for that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Does Mr. Fuller think we should put in the word the department is available for
Mr.
the
Chairman,
department?
Mr. Fuller.
Senator Tomasoni, you might want to, after available, say to the commissioner. If that's what's intended, and it probably is, you can always change it later if it's not.
Okay.
Are you comfortable with that, Senator Thomas?
Yes.
Senator Bonoff, would you move that oral amendment?
So moved.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The oral amendment is adopted. Then Senator Bonoff moves that Senate file 1879 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, we have Senator Franzen. Is she here?
Okay.
It's Franzen. Yeah. Senator Franzen, Senate file 2274.
Oh,
Senator Franz, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Please don't kill my bill.
Okay, we'll try not to.
So, Senate File 2274 is Women in Non-Traditional High-Wage Skill Workforce. This bill before you today is designed to address the approximately 40% of the gender pay gap that is attributed to women doing different work than men, or occupational segregation, and the higher value placed on male-dominated work. Desegregation of the workforce stalled in the 90s and is now increasing among younger workers. Only 29% of Minnesota men work in sales and service occupations, compared to 63% of African-American, 62% of American Indian, and 57% of Latina women. Now is the perfect time to be addressing the underrepresentation of women in many high-wage, high-demand occupations and its significant contribution to the pay gap. According to Deed in Minnesota, the Minnesota construction industry will generate 34,400 new jobs by the end of the decade, a growth rate of nearly 40%, but in 2011 to 2012, only 3% of construction program completers at Minnesota's technical colleges were women, and 3% construction laborers, 1.8% of plumbers, 3.3% of electricians, and 1.9% of carpenters were women. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Deborah Fitzpatrick, who will walk through the bill and share a rationale for the policy approach taken in the bill.
Okay, perfect. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Senator Franzen. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I direct the Center on Women and Public Policy at the Humphrey School at the University of Minnesota. And I lead an ongoing partnership with the Women's Foundation of Minnesota examining the status of women and girls in the state of Minnesota. I'm here today to build on Senator Franzen's remarks about gender segregation in the workforce, how it contributes to economic inequality, and some possible solutions that are proposed in the bill before you today. As Senator Franzen mentioned, workforce segregation remains an important problem and an important driver of the pay gap, which stands at 80, where full-time earners in Minnesota, women earn 80% of what men earn overall. And the gap continues for younger workers in the state. And current state and federal workforce development programs are a critically important potential intervention point. Unfortunately, our current workforce development efforts nationally and here in Minnesota are not really targeted at addressing this particular problem and actually end up reinforcing occupational gender segregation and the gender wage gap. Nationally, for example, half of women participating in the workforce investment system receive training in clerical, office, or service occupations compared to just 14% of men. On the other hand, over half of men receive training in production, transportation, construction, and extraction occupations compared to just 6% of women. As you can see from the chart in the handout this continues in the state of Minnesota. There's a chart here which shows some of our workforce development programs and the percent of women that are trained in service occupations versus the percent that are trained in natural resources, construction, and maintenance, and the resulting pay discrepancies that come from as a result of completing those training programs. So gender stereotypes and traditions about the types of jobs that men and women can and should do, and women's lack of awareness about these jobs and the knowledge of their entry paths are significant obstacles to increasing their representation in these fields. Women may also lack the preparatory skills to be competitive in the selection process, and the selection requirements and procedures still have a disparate impact on women's acceptance into apprenticeship programs. The bill before you today was developed in consultation with Wider Opportunities for Women, a national organization working in multiple states to address gender segregation in the workforce. You have a letter of support in your packets from Wider Opportunities for Women. We also consulted with organizations in the community, including AEOA, and you have a letter in your packets from them as well. Organizations like AOEA have been working successfully on this issue here in Minnesota. In addition, we consulted with the Department of Employment and Economic Development and post-secondary institutions. Based on suggestions from these stakeholders, the bill tackles the challenge of workforce segregation in four important ways. In Section 1 of the bill, we add a women and non-traditional work perspective to the Governor's Workforce Development Council, an approach that has made a significant difference in some other states. In Sections 3, 4, and 5, the bill expands supports for employers, workforce organizations, job counselors, case managers, secondary and post-secondary educational institutions, and ideally partnerships of these, to recruit, prepare, place, and retain women in non-traditional occupations and apprenticeships, especially low-income women and older women. This additional support would be provided through a new competitive deed grant program and through additional resources for the Department of Labor and Industries efforts to recruit, train, place, and retain women in skilled trade apprenticeship programs. Finally, it requires DEED to track the impact of state workforce development programs on workforce segregation and the pay gap. Overcoming the historical and cultural obstacles that prevent women from accessing these higher wage, non-traditional careers is challenging and requires direct intervention. According to independent research, targeted effective workforce programs such as the Federal Women in Entrepreneurship and Non-Traditional Occupations program, which is very similar to the approach we're advocating for in this bill today, do make a difference. WANTO, which, again, this program that we're proposing today is modeled after, provides a needed specialized assistance to address barriers which other workforce investment programs currently cannot and do not offer. Despite its modest funding level, WANTO has consistently produced outsized impact. As an independent study has shown, when programs are funded by this program, were implemented in an area, local women were 25% more likely to hold a non-traditional job, and that even years after the policy intervention, women were still more likely to hold non-traditional jobs in these areas. So as wider opportunities for women states in their support letter, by investing in a largely untapped labor pool, fostering a diverse workforce, and creating a real pipeline for women to enter into non-traditional industries, the proposed bill pursues an important and proven economic development strategy for the state. Lori Janitopoulos was planning to be here to testify from the Iron Range. Unfortunately, she had an emergency come up at the last minute and wasn't able to be here. But there is a letter in your packets from her that does a nice job of describing the great work they're doing on the Iron Range to address this issue successfully. And it's a great example of what we can do more of under this bill today. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Are there any questions for Senator Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just a question I have regarding under the appropriations section 5.24 or 5.25. It says funds available under this section must not supplant other funds available for the same purposes. Senator, could you tell me what other funds are out there, and if there are other funds, why do we have a separate program? Why are we not adding to that? I just don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I think Ms. Fitzpatrick can answer that question in more detail.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I think this is really just designed to say if under existing grant programs such efforts were funded. So, for example, AEOA currently gets some funding from the Adult Competitive Workforce Development Grant Program to do the kinds of work that's described in their letter. I think the idea is that we would just want this to be new additional work that would be funded through this program, and they couldn't sort of say, well, we funded this program over here, so that counts towards this or that kind of thing, I think is what we were trying to address. So, I mean, ideally, we would hope that this new money might augment some of those existing programs and maybe be able to be used, for example, in a fast-track program if they were in a working in a partnership where it was a non-traditional field, that maybe they might access some of these additional funds to help them recruit women to be part of that fast-track program. But we just wanted to make sure that this was an augmentation and not just a replacement, I guess, of current whatever current efforts might be going on.
Does that help, Senator Weber?
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me some of these other funds that you referred to, Ms. Fitzpatrick? Are they some of them already designed specifically for this purpose, and what's the total amount that we're talking about there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I think somebody from the department would be better able to sort of talk about the scope of all these other programs, but I don't think any of them are addressed specifically to deal with this. Some of them have chosen to do some of these sorts of activities like AEOA. Some of them, for example, prioritize working with MFIP recipients and those kinds of things, so they are working with women, and you know, they could choose to, you know, work to get those women into non-traditional fields, but the programs aren't designed specifically to do that. And what tends to happen, what the data shows, is that it's what's happening is that men and women are being funneled into traditional fields in those programs currently because they're not specifically targeted at this particular issue.
Thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Fitzpatrick? Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question, maybe more of a concern. It seems like we really don't know what other funds are out there, how much they are. So I'm not so sure that we're passing good legislation when we say that the funds cannot supplant other funds when we haven't identified the other funds. That makes me a little nervous that we put that language in there, but we don't. Nobody's able to tell us what we might be supplanting. So I guess I would like to do a oral amendment to strike funds available through, so 524, starting with funds available going through 525, so that we know where we're at.
And if you did that too, Senator Dames, on line 5.31, there's another duplicate, same language.
And have to come out also.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, your thoughts on that, or Senator Franzen? It's your bill.
Mr. Chair, I think that's fine. The intention for this money is to be targeted, so I think we still have the intent of the bill.
Okay. Do members understand that? Then Senator Dames' oral amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The oral amendment is adopted. Then, Senator Nelson, would you like to move?
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 2274 as amended.
You recommend the pass?
Recommended to pass and laid over.
Committee on Finance.
And we referred to Finance.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. The motion
no.
prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank
Senator
you, Mr. Chair, members.
Is Senator Sorry. Jensen in the room? If not, Senator Coonan, are you ready to go?
Yep.
Okay. Senator Coonan, welcome to the committee.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. What I'm presenting today is Senate File 1784, and what this bill does is requires an employer to provide veterans with time off for Veterans Day, and that is providing the time off would not impact public health or safety, or it would not cause the employer significant economic or operational disruption. And the employer can decide if the time off will be paid or not paid. And an employee is required to give an employer a 30-day written notice of intent to take time off if they wanted to take time off on Veterans Day. And the employer will notify the employee 10 days before the Veterans Day if time off is paid or not, and an employer cannot provide time off for all employees, if the employer cannot provide time off for all the employees, time off will be denied to as few employees as possible. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fuller brought to my attention a fix that probably needed to take place in the bill. It's amendment, the A2 amendment. And what it does is if you look at the wording up on line 1.9, starting after the number 2, cause the employer to experience significant economic or operational disruption. And then if you go down, and this is what the amendment refers to, down to line 21, at the end of that sentence, starting with maintain minimum operational capacity as applicable. And it was felt that these two could be interpreted quite a bit differently, and so what the amendment does is change the wording to be the same in both areas there. Okay. So there's no question about interpretation.
This is the first stop, too, so we can just offer this.
This is actually the second stop.
Okay, yeah. So we do have to have this amendment. So are members comfortable with the A2 amendment that Senator Coonan just explained? Okay, Senator Coonan moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted.
All right, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the idea for this bill was brought to me from Stephanie Vorvik, who works at the Chippewa County Veterans Service Officer, and she's the benefit coordinator for Chippewa County. And she got the idea from visiting with veterans as they came into the office, and she tells me that there are 245,000 veterans in the state who have not yet reached retirement age, and so this bill is very important to Ms. Vorovic. She was here for the first meeting in state and local government, but could not get away again today, but would appreciate your consideration of this bill.
Sounds like you put a lot of work into it. Do members have any questions for Senator Coonan, or would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 1784? Senator Rood?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coonan. So as we pass this legislation, what's the difference between having this legislation in place and an employee just going up to their employer and say, can I have the day off? Because it's paid or unpaid, and it's notice, and I'm just, what's the purpose of the legislation versus just having an employee? Because according to this, the employer can say, no, you can't. And it's paid or it's not paid. So I'm just wondering what the purpose of this was.
Senator Coonan?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rood, then I think you're right. I'm sure that's happening now where employees go to their employers and ask for the day off and get it. This is a little more formal process. And you're right. It doesn't require employees to pay the time off. It does, and the employee, by the way, has to give a 30-day notice, which gives the employer time to plan for the potential giving the employee a day off. And the employer has to notify the employee 10 days in advance if they'll get the day off and if it's paid or not. So it's a little more formal process. Ms. Vorovic, and I guess I've noticed this too, and maybe all of you have noticed, you go to Veterans Day programs, and it's the people who the veterans attending generally tend to be older, and so it was her wish, Ms. Vorvik's wish, that this would sort of nudge the younger veterans to pay attention, and of course for those who would like to go, it's a formal process of getting that process for the day off started.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any further questions for Senator Coonan? Do we need that? I don't know. I have to ask him. Brian.
We can finesse it. The page and lines are off. We should probably get the right bill.
seems like this isn't the right bill. Okay, amendment.
He's on the committee. Just hold it over and bring it back up for vote.
Mr. Fuller just informed us, Senator Coonan, that we might have a little hiccup here. Mr. Fuller, maybe you can explain what's going on.
Mr. Chairman, my eagle-eyed compatriot here saw that this, there's a first engrossment. We don't have it. If you look at the amendment, it's off a line, so there must have been some language added. So it would probably be appropriate to get the right bill here. And since Senator Conan's on the committee, are you going to be here? We can take it up short, you know, just shortly, okay, and readopt the amendment to the right page and line and do it right.
Would that be okay with you, Senator Coonan? We can get this corrected and then still get it out of here yet today?
Yes, okay. Mr. Chairman, that's just fine with me.
Okay, yeah. Then we'll just lay Senate File 1784 on the table temporarily. you want to go? I don't think. Yeah, Senator Eakin, if you want to go. Senator Eakin, Senate File 2111. Welcome to the committee, Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would, we are here today to discuss Senate File 2111. And I do have an author's amendment to put it in the shape and form that I would like.
All right. Let's get that out to everyone. Senator Eakin, this is the first committee, so he'd like to get the bill in the shape he would like. All those in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Eakin, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the amendment that was added was a change that was actually recommended by deed. There was a list of reasons to justify claims of those that were the victims of domestic abuse in the statute, and a similar standard was not applied to any other provisions for filing a claim. So that's why this list was removed in the amendment to provide consistency and to remove the prejudicial treatment for victims of domestic violence and also for sexual assault and stalking. And under current law, an individual who must quit or is terminated from their job due to domestic abuse is eligible to file for unemployment compensation. And Senate File 2111 extends that eligibility so that it would also include victims of sexual violence or stalking. This bill is part of a package of legislation that's been introduced as the Women's Economic Security Act. And this bill, other states have included sexual assault and stalking in their unemployment eligibility laws, states like Illinois, Oregon, and Hawaii. Also, the reauthorized Federal Violence Against Women Act has established a national precedence for creating consistency and extending support available to victims of domestic violence to victims of sexual assault and stalking as well. So there is a federal precedent here. A victim of sexual assault or stalking may need to quit a job for safety reasons, as well as to have time to address medical and therapeutic needs. And this bill provides the financial security that they need to get to safety and to seek the help and resources that will aid them in their recovery. This bill was developed by MnCASA, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, in consultation with employment law advocates, the Minnesota Bar Association Labor Law Section, and Lee Nelson and Judge Craig Gustafson from Thede. It has the support of the Bar Association's Human Rights Committee, as well as the Minnesota Women's Consortium and the network of advocacy groups supporting the Women's Economic Security Act. And I do have with me today Carolyn Palmer from the law, who is the law and policy manager from NCASA, to testify on further testify on the details of the bill.
Wonderful, Ms. Palmer, welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Caroline Palmer. I'm the law and policy manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Our member programs are sexual assault advocacy programs located all around the state. Thank you very much for this opportunity to bring this issue to the committee, and thank you very much to Senator Ekin for bringing this bill forward. Senator Ekin provided you some terrific background on this bill, so I think what I will do is just give you a little more detail about some of the changes that we're making in the statute. And again, I also would like to emphasize we did work closely with the department, with DEED, and we also had some good input from the Human Rights Committee at the State Bar Association and the Labor and Employment Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association. So I think we've done a lot of background work to help move this through. One of the things that you'll notice is, as Senator Ekin pointed out, we've removed a list. And that list that currently exists in statute involves applications for victims of domestic abuse. We want to be really clear that removing this list doesn't change anything about the process of applying for unemployment insurance or for this exception. Actually, as was mentioned, DEED felt it was time to treat these types of applications similarly to other types of applications, like somebody who may be looking for an exception under medical reasons, chemical dependency, sexual harassment. This is actually terrific news for us in the sexual assault movement, because we are really happy to see claims by victims of sexual assault, stalking, and domestic abuse treated similarly to all other types of unemployment insurance claims. We see this as real progress. Overall, this change definitely creates consistency within the statute, and we know that's important as well. We are thankful that DEED was willing to work with us on this bill. We did come to them a little bit later in the process in January. They do normally have their vetting process in the fall, but they were willing to work with us. And we know that they cannot formally support the bill because of that timing. But again, they provided good input. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, even though that list has been removed, somebody who's applying for unemployment insurance with one of these exceptions can still provide any kind of evidence as they put their application through the process. And really, that list, in a way, was somewhat misleading, because the list may have indicated to some people that if you submitted these types of documentation, your application would be automatically granted, and it really wasn't the case. It needs to go through a process to be vetted and to be determined whether or not it actually meets all the requirements of the department. The standard of review that is applied is a preponderance of evidence. And the bill does include references to the relevant criminal law statutes that would apply. So you'll see that we're talking about the criminal sexual conduct statute and also the stalking statute. And currently, the statute already includes references to the domestic abuse statutory code. I guess the one other thing I'd like to add is that we're requesting this change to the statute not because there's really so many cases. In fact, it's our understanding that there's only been a handful of cases over the years of people coming to DEED and asking for an exception based on their status as a victim of domestic abuse. But what we do believe is that for the handful of people who would benefit from this bill, this would really make a significant part of their recovery come to pass. They would be able to work on stability, work on their health, and support an immediate family member if the immediate family member is the victim as they're going through that process. We all know that access to economic security is a means to safety. A victim needs to be able to act proactively to protect self and family. Unemployment insurance will provide that peace of mind while the victim attends to personal or family needs. So I'm happy to answer any questions, or I may also ask the department to come to the table to answer questions.
Sure, that'd be fine. Ms. Palmer, thank you for your testimony. And this is an important bill, Senator Ekin, so I think we want to move it. But I think, as a general practice, I think it is important to go before the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, just for members' understanding. But does someone from the department want to? Senator Root has a question. Well,
And Senator Sparks, to that point, I appreciate you bringing this forward, and I am a co-author on the bill, so I think it's an important bill. But I do have concerns that it did not go through that process, and I'm just wondering, you know, my understanding that was that it would. So I do have that concern also.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, yes,
Senator Ekin.
Somebody who would like to testify to that.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and I've served on the UI Advisory Council for 6 years, and our colleagues have served on the council before that. I've heard some of these concerns about this bill and maybe other bills not going through the UI Advisory Council, and I just wanted to just kind of make a note that that council really is, it's an informal group of stakeholders that has come together to advise DEED on its proposals. And it's never really served, or it's not supposed to serve, as a gatekeeping mechanism for good ideas. And so that group meets September, October, November. And if you had a constituent that had a UI problem that you came, you know, if you had that problem in the last month or so, I don't think it's ever been conceived that all legislation or all ideas have to go through that council. It's a good place to vet ideas, but there are a lot of groups missing from that council, and it's certainly not an exhaustive place to vet UI legislation. So as a member of that council, I have absolutely no qualms or concerns that this legislation didn't come through that process. It's a limited process of people volunteering, volunteering kind of their time as stakeholders.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. You want to follow? Okay. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm unsure about the process here when a claim is made for unemployment insurance. Now, as I understand, they would qualify, even though this did not, the abuse, the stalking did not occur in the workplace, but they would still qualify for that. Is the employer, is the employer held liable for that claim then at that point? Is that going to go against the employer's record, for example, in the determination of their unemployment insurance rate?
Ms. Palm, someone else is coming forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Gustafson. I'm the Chief Unemployment Law Judge with DEED. Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, in the case when someone quits their employment and they work for what we call a taxpaying employer, those benefits would not be charged back to the experience rating of that employer. In the case of reimbursing employers, that's one of the things that reimbursing employers do. They don't have that same exception as taxpaying employers. So if you're a reimbursing employer, such as a nonprofit government entity that pays back exactly what your former workers have received in benefits, those would be charged back to the reimbursing employer.
Okay. Senator Weber, did that help?
My question. Thank you.
Okay.
Yep.
You're welcome. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gustafson, for your input. Any further discussion on Senate File 2111? If not, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 2111, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Those in favor, say aye.
Question?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Weber.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. your comment about going through the other committee, what are you going to do with that at that point then? About the Unemployment Committee.
The UI Advisory Council
process, yeah.
Well, I think we just raised, both Senator Root and I just said, I think in the future that's not a practice that we want to start to have happen around here.
Okay.
And we heard a little bit from Ms. Webster, but this bill will go to the Finance Committee. And then they can have, I don't know if someone from the department, I believe they stayed neutral just because of that fact. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but.
Mr. Chair.
Senator James.
I think it would be good if we could have somebody from the council weigh in on this, before it goes to the next committee.
Okay.
I really am concerned about, it looks pretty open-ended to me, and I understand that we heard some testimony on it, but I think it's pretty open-ended, and I'd like to hear some weigh in from somebody from the actual that's on the advisory council. That could be done before the next committee that goes.
Here we got a couple right here, Ms. Schaubeck and Mr. Calgari.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Rick Caligiuri. I'm the Director of Unemployment Insurance. The UI Advisory Council is not a statutory council. It used to be. In the 1980s, there was a big push because there were so many statutory boards and councils to get them out of statute. So prior to that time, it was statutory. It is no longer statutory, but it is a board that advises the department and the governor and the legislature on complicated matters of unemployment insurance. I mean, this is the basically all the statutes on unemployment insurance. And at that council, there's kind of a broad array of interests there of folks who have a vested interest in public policy regarding unemployment insurance. You know, labor is there, business groups are there, chamber is there, and so the normal process with unemployment insurance issues, particularly the issues that the department would move, would be to vet them with this board prior to the session, and then of course they go through the once there's consensus with that board that things are not controversial, then it goes to the governor's office and then comes to the legislature. There are legislators on the advisory committee as well. There are 8 legislators, 4 from each party and each body. So there's kind of equal representation there. And we do invite all entities to vet any public policy relative to unemployment insurance at those meetings.
Ms. Shawback?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Shawback. I'm the legislative director at the AFL-CIO and also a representative on the UI Advisory Council. And when this did go through the House committee, Marion O'Neill, Representative O'Neill, I should say, brought that fact up, and she is a member on the UI Advisory Council. And myself in the chamber actually got up and spoke to the fact that we would like to see it go through, but the bill did come in later after we had stopped meeting. But we fully support the bill, myself, as labor does. I'm not sure where the chamber is on it right now. I don't think they're opposing it at this point. But we did have that discussion, and we went before the House committee and said we're okay with it.
Mr. Chair, I just also want to make clear, we're very new to this whole process. It's not usually a field we're working in. We weren't aware of the council, so when we brought the bill in January, we learned about all of this process. So just want to be clear that, you know, we were all kind of working it through as we went along.
Senator Eakin.
And Mr. Chair, and I just thought, you know, the council meets a rather brief time period during the year, and as I was already testified to, there's problems that emerge after it's done meeting before the session. Not sure if we want to start the president either of requiring that everything has to go through there before legislative action can take place.
Okay. Then I think we've vetted this pretty good. I think that, Senator Rood, your point was well taken. I brought it up too, but I think this bill is probably in pretty good shape. So, again, Senator Eakin removes his motion that Senate file 2111 is amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen's been waiting patiently, so I think we'll move back to her if she's ready. Senator Jensen has Senate file 2158.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do have an author's amendment, A1.
Okay.
Just to put it in the shape that I'd like it to be in before we discuss it.
Okay. Senator Schmidt would move the A1 amendment for Senator Jensen. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Senator Jensen, to your bill.
Thank you. This is Senate file 2158. While Minnesota is one of the top states in the country for many things, unfortunately, it's not for women-owned businesses. We're ranked 39th in the country for growth in women-owned businesses and only 32nd in revenue growth. We own just over 1 in 4 businesses in Minnesota, and the overwhelming majority of those are not in high-growth industries. Just as an example, my mom and I started a personalization studio at a time in my life when I was transitioning between family situations, and it created basically a good tax write-off, but it really would not support myself and my 2 kids if I had to rely on that income to survive and to pay my bills and to be able to be successful. Although it was completely rewarding and something that I would do again. If I didn't have the help of my parents during that time, I would not have been able to survive financially because of that. Well, and one of the most common things that happen in these situations is, for women, it's hard to have access to capital, and we're not as prone to taking risk, and we feel unprepared, and that's especially true in high-growth industries. But I think that's something that we can help change. And what this bill does is it would create, and this is important, so I want you to fully understand that what this does is it creates a competitive grant so that other organizations that have programs already in place that help women prepare for the role of entrepreneur in fields like technology and construction that would create the kind of business that you would be able to be successful if you did it on your own. The program receiving the grants would provide training or help develop investor networks to women who want to become entrepreneurs. And we want to find those women and recruit those women that are already working, probably in a high-stress, economically impact job, just not as the entrepreneur themselves. So this would help those women make that leap and take that step. I have some people with me today that are going to talk a little bit more about this. And first, I introduce Barb Batiste. And if it's okay with the committee, I'd like for her to take
over.
Welcome
to the committee. Thank you, Senator Jensen.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barbara Batiste. I'm director of the Legislative Office on the Economic Status of Women. The Office on the Economic Status of Women is part of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. It's a nonpartisan joint House and Senate office. Its statutory mandate is to research and report to legislators on all issues that relate to women's economic status. And through the 38 years that OESW has been in existence, it's also become a liaison between the community and the legislature on women's economic issues. Senate File 2158 sets up a two-year competitive grant program to encourage and help women entrepreneurs to start high-growth, high-revenue businesses. I've been asked by Senator Jensen to testify today on the research about women-owned businesses that points to the need for such a program. Now, there is a lot of good news about women-owned businesses. Women are increasingly taking control of their economic destinies by starting businesses. Nationally, the number of business startups by women is rising 1.5 times as fast as the rate of total business startups. There's especially good news for women of color. African American women are starting businesses at a rate 6 times that of the general population. In fact, half of all African American-owned businesses are owned by women. Over the past 16 years, the number of all women-owned businesses grew by 59%, which is impressive. But in the same period, the number of firms owned by women of color increased 156% to 2.7 million and now represents approximately 1 in 3 of women-owned businesses. But there's also news about women-owned businesses that is concerning. The vast majority of women-owned businesses are smaller than the average firm, both in revenue and in number of employees. The average revenue of women-owned businesses is only 27% of male-owned businesses. Although women-owned businesses make up 29% of all businesses, they employ only about 6% of the U.S. workforce and contribute just under 4% of U.S. business revenue. The percent of total U.S. business revenue attributable to women-owned firms has not increased since 1997. In Minnesota, 1 in 4 businesses is owned by women, but only 12% of women-owned businesses have paid employees. Women-owned businesses in general are much smaller than the average U.S. business. On average, a women-owned business employs 1 person in addition to the owner and has annual revenue of just under $155,000. This is less than half the size of the typical privately held U.S. business, which employs 2 in addition to the owner and generates an average annual revenue of just over $400,000. You will and have heard much this session about the gender pay gap. Usually the gender pay gap refers to women workers, to employees. Interestingly, a similar gender pay gap exists for women business owners. In 2010, incorporated full-time self-employed women in Minnesota earned 80 cents on a comparable man's dollar. And those women entrepreneurs without incorporation earned just 46 cents on the dollar of their male entrepreneur peers. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I now have Elaine Wyatt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Elaine Wyatt, and I'm the Executive Director of Women Venture. I wanted to start by thanking you for your support through our deed program revenue and the support of many other funders to support our program. Last year, that support resulted in our ability to start 194 businesses. We created 307 jobs that were brought $5 million of salaried income into the market and $8 million in gross sales. Although women's businesses are growing rapidly, there is still disparity in Minnesota, where only a quarter of women business, only a quarter of the businesses are led by women. Even greater disparity lies in the revenue growth of women-owned firms, where Minnesota ranks 32nd in the country. While Women Venture is doing good and important work in this market, we continue to see a lack of women starting businesses in male-dominated fields, the type of businesses that generate high-paying jobs. Our donors came to us and were concerned about this issue. As a part of our strategic work, we really went and looked nationally to see if anybody else was addressing this issue and having success. In our analysis, we uncovered a program called the Activate Program, and it was developed out of the University of Maryland. It now is in three other markets. I have some information, I think, in your handouts that goes deeper into the Activate program. When Maryland looked at their entrepreneurial landscape, they made a decision to try to activate 50% more of the market that was working in high tech but not starting and growing businesses. Their underlying belief in this program is that entrepreneurs can be recruited and developed. The concept of the program is to recruit women either out of mid-careers in male-dominated industries to launch businesses or to target women who are leading firms that have the potential to grow exponentially. The program is tied to universities in every state that it's in and takes advantage of commercializing university and federal laboratory technology and intellectual property. The program has been supported by the Kauffman Foundation on Entrepreneurship and the National Science Foundation Partnership for Innovation. This is one of the ways that this issue could be addressed and the model that Women Venture would propose if the competitive grant application process was approved.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, and now Barb Burr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Barb Burr, and I founded Step One Foods. My co-founder, Elizabeth Clotus, is a local cardiologist. We are a mission-driven business, and we want to change the paradigm of healthcare. Our goal is to provide simple solutions for people who prefer food to drugs, but struggle to make the necessary changes to their diet and lifestyle. I'm here today to share the challenges I faced as an entrepreneur in Minnesota. Like any business, we need capital to raise awareness and grow our business. Without question, the biggest challenge we've faced has been access to that capital. First, traditional sources of capital are not available to startups. Banks require 3 years of profitability. That's not realistic. We did have a loan with a small business bank for a short time, and they were simply not set up to work with us, despite the fact that we personally guaranteed and 100% collateralized that loan. SBA loans are available for asset-based purchases like equipment. We have a small manufacturing business. Our equipment needs are minimal. Instead, our needs are labor-based. We want and need to hire people to help grow our business. We need help with manufacturing, in our warehouse, and with sales and marketing. These are well-paying jobs, not entry-level. But no bank accepts an employee base as collateral for a loan. Women Venture is the only organization that has been willing to work with us. They provided loans that helped us keep the lights on while we did product development and got our foods ready for market. They also provided loans so that we could buy equipment and increase our production capacity at our small facility. They have shared their Rolodex and helped us in other countless ways. Their help has been unique and invaluable. Second, we expected to find opportunities within the state of Minnesota to participate in helping to improve the health of Minnesotans and control the costs of their care. The response we've had from government agencies has frankly left us puzzled. To give you just one example, we were introduced to a person at the Minnesota Department of Health by someone in New Mexico's Department of Health. This is literally the response we got over the phone. Oh, I don't think I can talk to a business. I thought the best way to end my statement today is to contrast our experience in Minnesota with our experience working with Canada. The provincial government of Manitoba has embraced our business. We purchased several of their ingredients, and they approached us and asked us if we would be interested in a joint venture. They intend to fund half of our clinical trial, which will take place at our own Mayo Clinic and at the University of Manitoba. They've also provided a team of food scientists who are helping us develop our second product line for prediabetes. Manitoba sees several opportunities in our relationship. Economic growth for their farmers whose ingredients we use in our products. Economic savings for their Ministry of Health as they incorporate our products into their care stream. The chance to be pioneers in the area of condition-specific foods. Manufacturing jobs as we move into the Canadian market. We would love to see the same response and support in our own home state. And we would love to see women venture continue to flourish and provide support to businesses like ours. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Burr. Great stories that you all shared with us. Senator Jensen, is there anyone else that you had to testify today?
I don't.
Okay. Any questions from members? Senator Nelson.
Comment, Mr. Chair. I'm very glad to be a co-sponsor on this bill. And I believe, you know, if we had our bring your own device technology working, I'd be able to send you this article from Forbes so you all could see it. But let me just tell you enough to kind of whet your interest here. February 8th of this year, Forbes has an article, 11 Reasons 2014 Will Be a Breakout Year for Women Entrepreneurs. And I believe that women entrepreneurs can actually lead the way for women shattering ceilings all across our economic landscape. And so I thank Senator Jensen for bringing this bill forward. And I think there's a lot of opportunity here, and I'm very glad to support this bill.
Excellent. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Ms. Batiste, and I'm sorry, you had mentioned some numbers, and they were formulating a question in my mind, and I didn't get them written down.
Yes.
You know us guys, we don't multitask very well. But anyway, you women all wanted to say it, didn't you, Senator Nelson? Yeah, I know.
I thought you were just
No, but you were commenting about the women run our own businesses and they generate X number percent less. I was towards the end of your comments there.
So there are two figures. One is in general, women-owned businesses generate 27% of the revenue that male-owned businesses generate.
Okay.
Is that the figure?
That probably was one of them, yes. And I guess and my question is, what are the reasons given for that, and how does the proposed bill help solve that issue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I am so glad you asked that because I forgot the last two paragraphs of my testimony, which I really want to say, which starts, why is this happening? Thank you. This is a major reason it's happening is that women-owned businesses tend to start businesses in industry sectors that aren't high economic impact, and that means they don't generate high revenue, they don't employ a lot of paid employees. And that's because women-owned businesses tend to cluster in the sectors of healthcare and social assistance, educational services, administrative support services, and other services. And women-owned businesses are largely and vastly underrepresented in the higher economic impact sectors of finance and insurance, transportation and warehousing, and construction. And it's particularly unfortunate that they are so underrepresented in construction and transportation because in those two industry sectors, women-owned businesses generate the same amount of revenue as male-owned businesses. But In construction, women are only 7% of the U.S. construction firms, and they're only 11% of the U.S. transportation firms. And thank you.
Well, thank you. I was interpreting your comments to mean that male-owned or female-owned, the same type of business was generating those kind of differences. And so that's why I was not tracking that whatsoever. So thank you.
Further discussion, members. Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Jensen, I understand you're requesting a $500,000 appropriation to the commissioner indeed for these grants. What would be the maximum grant that any one individual could apply for?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Deems, the way that this is set up is that this would go to organizations. So my understanding is the full $500,000 could go as a competitive grant to an organization that already has programs set up and established to provide the kind of mentorship and resources that, as an example, Women Venture has been able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't set up so that we can hand out little bits of money to women that are interested in being entrepreneur. This is set up so that we can find, recruit, encourage, and enhance the ability of women that would be excellent at this, that just haven't found the courage or the ability to do that because of some of the barriers that are set up when you look at some of the capital and some of those types of things that present themselves when a woman does take the risk to start their own business. So we want this to be something that we would encourage high economic impact businesses, mm-hmm, with high-paying jobs to be developed out of this. So that's what the appropriation is for.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Now, I'm assuming that the Department of Deed would be tracking the success of the businesses that receive these grants. And if that's the case, can you tell me what kind of measurements would be used to determine, sure, the impact of this investment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Deems, that we're not giving the money to businesses, so there's nothing to track as far as if they're actually do it. This money would be given to organizations that, okay, do that. So if we needed to have some kind of a monitor, it would be on the organization that received the grant.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Deems.
And what would be the measures then that organization would use or would be used to determine if that organization was having success in the grant money?
Thank you, Senator Deems.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deems, I'm hoping maybe there's somebody from the Department of Deed that could, okay, speak to this.
Let's see if someone from the department's available to comment to Senator Deems' question. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Kim Babine. I am the Director of Government Affairs at Deed. I was listening, but I want to make sure I answer exactly the right question. So would you mind repeating your question, Mr.
Senator
Chair?
Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is how will we track the success of the investment that's giving to the organization or organizations? How will you track to see if that investment is being successful and how successful it is? And what measurements will you use?
Ms. Babine?
Mr. Chair, members, the way the department typically runs our competitive grant program is there would be specific measures that would be set out in an RFP that then organizations would respond to. So those would be fleshed out in more detail during an RFP process. There are specific things in the bill that that are listed that organizations should be doing, and those are the type of things that we would be looking for. We generally want to see organizations in this particular instance that how they're going to reach businesses, how many people they're serving, what are their outcomes. Other specific measures would need to be identified. I'm trying to, excuse me, remember. Right. Businesses, a number of different technical assistance pieces that then the businesses or the organizations would be providing would be how we would track success.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pavitt. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To a representative of the department, we previously approved a program with another $500,000 grant. Mm-hmm. We were talking about jobs as opposed to businesses, per mm-hmm. se. Now, do you see a cooperative venture within the department to, I mean, so we aren't reinventing the wheel, that basically the same administrative process is used to mm-hmm. handle both? Are these all going to, I know there are separate programs, but mm-hmm. sometimes I worry that we create separate programs and we suck too much off in terms of administration. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying this of DEED in particular. I'm saying this of government in general. Do you see those being coordinated to work together?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, definitely. The department operates a number of competitive grant programs. The ones that have been discussed here today, we have a business development competitive adult and youth workforce, and so the department has gotten pretty good at administering the RFPs and doing the reporting that's required for these types of grant programs. So we, in terms of the administrative costs that it would take, we keep those as low as possible. Often it'll say, you know, up to 5% may be used. We never use more than we need to and have demonstrated ability to, or demonstrated that sometimes we hit at 4% and sometimes we hit at 3%. But yes, the teams would work together. Our grant coordinators work together and share information, so we're not reinventing the wheel each time, even though each RFP is different because it's obviously directed at different folks. And there's a separate process that applicants would be different, the review of those applicants would be different, but we share information and coordinate as much as possible.
Very good. Good questions. Senator Nelson, would you like to move Senate File 2158 as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance?
Yes, so moved.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
If it's okay with members, I think we'll take up Senator Coonan's bill and get that fixed up. We have the first engrossment now here, and so maybe Mr. Fuller can just explain what we're going to do. Do we have to take this off the table? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, the reason we wanted to look at the first engrossment was to see if there's anything different, and it's not. It's just reorganized. So the amendment was properly adopted. We just had the wrong paper. So all we have to do now is move the bill as amended.
Okay. So do members understand what we're doing? If that's okay, then Senator Coonan would move that Senate File 1784 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Coonan. Senator Herr, are you ready with Senate File 2186?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Welcome to the committee.
Yep, thank you. The Senate 52186 is a housekeeping bill for 2014. The provision in this bill have been discussed and composed by diverse representatives of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council and have received consensus from DEED before it's presented here today. This bill has two parts. Article 1 mainly states the policy, and the Article 2 may change to simplify the bill for easy understand for business and individual. It also made modification to reduce interest rate on unemployment insurance related to death. And with me to speak on behalf of this bill is Michael Vaughn, Rick Caligiuri, and Craig Gustafson. So, Mr. Caligiuri, maybe you could begin.
Thank you. Welcome back to the committee. Thank you, Senator Herr.
Mr. Chair, members, again, I'm Rick Caligiuri, Director of Unemployment Insurance at DEED. And this is our UI bill for this year with all of the policy and technical things that we need to take care of this year. And it did go through the UI Advisory Council, and there was found that there was nothing controversial in here that anybody objected to, because in that process, when there are things that are controversial, we will drop them from the bill. I think the two major things in this bill are we're seeking to reduce the interest that both individuals and businesses would pay, and this would be individuals who committed fraud and collected unemployment insurance knowingly when they weren't eligible, and for businesses that that do not file their tax reports. We assess interest to both of those entities, and it is currently 18% interest, and we're asking to lower that to 12. The 18 was set in 1982, when interest rates were really high at that time. Prior to that, it had been 12% for about 30 years. You do need to have a significant interest rate to incent folks to pay back. We're under pressure from the federal government for the integrity of the program to recapture overpayments. And in assessing what other states charge for interest, the most common interest that other states charge is 12%. And so we're asking to lower the interest rate. And then the second major thing, which is also Governor's Uncession initiative, is that we're loosening the requirements, or lessening the requirement, the record-keeping requirement for businesses for their payroll records. We currently require them to keep payroll records for 8 years, and that just is not necessary, so we're lowering that to 4. It will really reduce reporting burden for the thousands of covered employers in Minnesota. And now I'll turn it over to Craig, and he can talk about some of the other housekeeping points.
Mr. Gustafson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have a A1 amendment here. Let's see, A14-0909.
Okay.
I'd like to move that we adopt the amendment.
Okay. Technical amendment, Senator Herr?
That's correct.
Okay. Senator Herr moves the A14-0909 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The A14 amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Mr. Gustafson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Article 1 is basically our policy sections that went through the UI Advisory Council. It includes 7 policy sections. 2 sections with the greatest impact are the reduction in the interest rate that Mr. Caligiuri already mentioned, and the reducing the employer records retention requirements from 8 to 4 years. Other provisions include a change in the standard of ownership for employer experience rating transfers, a clarification of severance pay as it affects eligibility for benefits, an exemption for attorneys from certain types of online filing requirements, and the exclusion of non-qualified stock options from counting as wages when exercised by a former employee. Article 2 of the bill includes 26 sections of housekeeping changes. These sections eliminate unnecessary language and make the statute easier to read and understand. Several of the sections are included to improve the organization of the statute and to repeal unnecessary and outdated statutes and administrative rules. If any members have any technical questions or other questions on the bill, Mr. Caligiuri and I'd be happy to answer them.
Sure. Any questions? Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gustafson, as you know, I served on that commission, and so I do appreciate that for anything to come before us, it does take a lot of work to get consensus around that table. So I do trust that that what we see is well vetted. But you said that statement pretty fast about how you're treating stock options, so I was wondering if you would go back and explain that to me.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, sorry for going so fast on that part. We discovered actually just one case where a former employee of a company had retired but was continuing to receive stock options over a period of several years. Each year that employee would receive enough in stock options, which were considered wages, to requalify for unemployment benefits. that former employee, she would file for unemployment benefits every year, even though she was no longer attached to the workforce. This simply closes that loophole so that someone who's in a retired status collecting stock options can't use those as wages to continue to requalify for benefits year after year.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Gustafson, so in that case, she would qualify because her wages were so low? So if she's getting wages, then what is the event that, it's hard to understand what is the event that would qualify her for the unemployment insurance?
Mr. Gustafson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, her employer, her former employer, would report her wages, and she would re-qualify based on those wages that they had reported. And so every year we would see a wage report from her, and she wasn't working. She could legitimately say, I'm available for work, I'm actively looking for work, and re-qualify for benefits. Does that make sense, Senator
Bonner? Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. That was helpful. Thank you. Further questions for the witnesses or Senator Dennis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gustafson or Mr. Calgary, whoever wants to answer this. On page 10, Article 2, there's quite a change in the agricultural employment language. Can you point out some of the differences that there's going to when we've taken a lot of it out and now we're referring to a different statute in here? Can you tell me, or different language? Can you tell me what those changes are? Or are there any differences from what it was before to what are you moving it to now?
Mr. Chair, which section are you referring to, Senator?
It's Article 2, Section 1, Subdivision 2, Agricultural Employment, page 10.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator, basically that section's included to shorten up the statute. That's simply a repetition of federal law. And so instead of repeating everything in federal law, we're simply including a cross-reference to the federal law.
So I take it, thank you, Mr. Chair, follow-up. I take it then there are no changes, it's just that you're taking out the repetition. Is that correct? Or are there changes?
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there are no substantive changes in that section. That's correct.
Thank you.
Good question. further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Herr, Clavin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Clavin, for the record, I represent a number of the ag groups, and I drew the short straw amongst my colleagues to come here and take a look at this bill. We understand it's non-controversial, and I don't make a habit of going to the UI Advisory Council, so like Senator Dames, thanks for asking that question. It moves a lot of words around. We're just taking a look at it, but taking their word for it, we don't have any objections, but we will be looking at it and let the author know if we see anything funny, but we shouldn't have a problem with it, but following Senator Dames' question, I just want to get on the record.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you for doing that. We'll certainly take your comments and continue to work with the department. Would anyone else like to be heard on the bill? Then Senator Herr moves that Senate file 2186 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Senator Herr. And last, members, on the agenda today is Senator Schmidt, Senate File 2065. You'll remember that we had quite a bit of discussion on this last week. We laid the bill over because committee members weren't quite comfortable, so I guess at this point we'd ask Senator Schmidt to come forward. I know he's been working with the stakeholders, and hopefully he'll have some good news to report to us. Senator Schmidt, welcome to the committee.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I hope I do have some good news to report. I'd like to get the A3 amendment before members right away here. And, of course, this is regarding a pilot program administered through Department of Labor and Industry, trying to make sure that we're catching the misclassification of construction workers and in classifying them appropriately. And we have an effort in the bill as it was originally written to make that pilot program permanent. A couple of concerns came up last week. You heard in committee on Thursday regarding the permanency of that pilot program. And what the A3 amendment before you now tries to do more than anything else is establish the extension of that pilot program rather than ending in 2014, extending it off to 2016. And so you'll see some new language stricken from the original Senate file 2065, reverting back to its original form and making clear that this is a pilot program extended to 2016. So we're taking some of those concerns to heart. I should just mention that we do have a report on the effectiveness of the program here and just some highlights. This pilot program has identified over 9,000 instruction employers in Minnesota and has a profile for each, has taken into account 80 registration enforcement orders, and identified 856 misclassified employees. So not quite 10%, but pushing it. And has received 53 referrals from DLI to possible tax violations reported to revenue. So the pilot project, those are just the highlights of its effectiveness and some of its initial findings. I think there's broad consensus that it's been a success, and we'd like to continue that. The question is as to whether or not to make it permanent or else to continue the pilot status. Of course, the A3 before you continues the pilot status. So with that said, I'd like to move the amendment if I could, Mr. Chair.
Let's just ask members if they have any questions. Do you understand what the author's trying to do? Okay. Any discussion? Then Senator Schmidt would move the A3 amendment to make it a pilot program extended for 2 more years. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The A3 amendment is adopted. So now we have Senate file 2065 in front of us. Would anyone else like to testify?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, we heard some great testimony last week. I don't necessarily think it's required today. I think folks have a pretty good sense of what this pilot project does, and I guess if there's nobody eager to testify, I would ask for movement on this bill.
Any further discussion, Senator Deems? You're okay. All right. Then Senator Schmidt, thank you for doing this work. I think it's important because the committee, we have jurisdiction. I think it is important that we do the work here in committee. So, Senator Schmidt, thank you for your work. Senator Schmidt moves that Senate file 2065 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Schmidt. Thank you very much, committee. We got a lot of work done today, so... we'll have another full agenda on Wednesday, but thank you. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.
So, damn.